Okay, this is a question for both the academics on the panel and the librarians on the panel, recognizing that what you're doing is breaking down that distinction in really exciting ways. And it's coming from someone who, me, who does ethnography in the ways that Tom Mullaney said he chose not to do it in the Grave Project. Goes to a town or a region or does multi-sided ethnography and writes a book that hopefully has some kind of complex and open-ended insights, if I'm really lucky. And I gather that what you're proposing is some kind of ongoing iteration between sort of big data, digital mapping representations, and what we might call experiences on the ground or in real places, or what I've heard called ground truthing as another location for knowledge in addition to the digital. And I'm wondering if some of you could provide examples of where you have found the most creative insights or the most exciting to you insights coming out of that iteration, which seems to me the most exciting place that we're, or exciting possibility that we're talking about here. I've been asked to bring this to whoever wants it next.
Can you hear me okay? No? Still no?
On the top.
This way? Maybe can you have a handheld mic?
No, it seems to be on.
Is there a channel issue?
Okay, I think we can, you can hear me now. Great. So there was this one moment, well, there's been several moments, but let me think about the translation aspect of this, and that has to do with a most recent example. I was talking to David Crawler, who's in our language translation team at the Cherokee Nation, and he was mentioning how word-by-word interlineal translation actually allows you to see the various forms of verbs that get mashed together. And he was helping me understand how the word gadugi, which is very, very common in the manuscripts that we've been seeing, it's gadugi or gadug. It's also the basis of the word skadug, which means community, nation, tribe, but it's also this word that means, it's the basis of the word for Gaduwa and Gaduwagia, and it's for all of our people. So what it really means is work teams, basically. But the work teams over time grow into governing bodies through their everyday actions of trying to solve problems and helping each other do their work. And it's how it is that we define ourselves as people. And so David Crawler and Ed Fields and Durbin Feeling were all really, really instrumental in helping me understand what I was seeing in these manuscripts happening over and over again and how this actually relates to an entire, literally the word that we call ourselves. That's a pretty good moment.
That's a wonderful question. And I would say that the field work has its own benefits. And what I have learned is they enable me to identify idiosyncratic processes. But when you put the data together, it allows me to see long-term, long-duration processes. One example, there's a phenomenon that I call music-derived literacy, for lack of better term. As I tried to investigate why Ajami literacy has emerged in many of these places, I noticed that music was always very central, that poetry was always very present, and that many of these communities actually did not acquire literacy through reading the alphabet, A, B, C, D, or through the Quranic school, which is believed to be the standard process. But in fact, Many of them were actually memorizing these beautiful poems, short ones, that contained local metaphors to which they could relate. And it was after memorizing these small poems that they were motivated to learn the script. So we see that here, literacy is actually acquired through a different channel, a channel that is quite different from the standard one. So that's an idiosyncratic pattern. But the big data enables me to see whether that phenomenon is a larger process. For example, if we go to Gabe's place in Ethiopia, do we have a similar pattern? And I think that's really where I see the benefits of the big data as enabling us to see the larger long-durée processes for that matter, Adamization itself. It preceded Arabic itself, ironically, because Arabic itself was an Adamized form of Aramaic script. It was Aramaic script that was actually modified by early Arabs to write Arabic. Huh. So it's the same process that's actually going on around the world. So that's where I really see the benefits of the big data as opposed to the ethnographic localized study.
That's a great example. Yeah. Nice question.
Me this time? Yes? Okay. Thank you guys so much for these talks. They're really fascinating and sort of a fascinating constellation of case studies that really touch on kind of literacy, the history of writing systems, how textual evidence can sort of lead us back to people's lives. And I could ask a question about that, but I won't. I'll ask a question about sort of the digital and the technological aspects of these projects. And one of the things that I've been thinking about today is how we haven't we've started talking a bit about labor, but we haven't talked really about platforms and the kind of nuts and bolts of the bases of some of these problems. I know the DPLA talks have touched on that, but about interoperability, about are these open source databases, but also are you using open source platforms, are they, that you know, my fear about digital humanities is the graveyard of sort of web 1.0, which is, you know, those bespoke sites that sort of don't, that require so much money to make and then so much money to maintain and then are sort of lost in the digital wilderness. And so we're at that, we have some of the best practices in the kinds of scholarly projects that are coming out of digital humanities these days. So I wondered how you guys are kind of collectively or individually thinking about future-proofing your own research tools.
It's a great question.
And while you're answering, I will bring this to the next question answer asker.
I can start.
Okay.
Can you hear me? Okay. So one project that I would highlight is actually something that the introducer highlighted was the Emblematica Online project, which could easily be a bespoke project of digitized emblem books. But we were in partnership with a German library, I can't speak the German, but it's the HAB Wolfenbüttel. And so in partnership, we developed metadata schema. And also in partnership with University of Utrecht and the metadata schema that they've developed called IconClass, working in partnership with these international institutions, building platforms about medieval studies, about emblem books that talk to each other, that link to each other, using collaborative metadata schema so that people that go to one site can go to the other, and also data backup so that we back up the German images, they back up ours, and also we've, with the next NEH grant, had two NEH grants, and the second one allowed us to add Glasgow and Utrecht, Duke and the Getty. So I see collaborative partnerships as a key way of taking what could be bespoke projects and making them into larger, sustained digital library projects.
That's a really important question. So I just want to try out an answer to your question or thought on your question, and then just also note the previous speaker's question, because I think it's an important one. I think the bespoke versus kind of modular debate is a really important one. I mean, the Graves Project is bespoke, and there is, and what I think the prevailing assumption that I know I held going into it was that the problem was when that you build a platform that is so so subject specific or so experience specific that it can't be modulated out or genericized. And now what I realized is that it's actually because it comes back to that question of labor and economy and how do you finance this? Because when I look at the platform now, all I can see is a replacement for PowerPoint. If in my lecture on the warlord period in China or the Second World War or the Northern Expedition or the Long March, I mean, I do end up creating these 1 gig, 4 gig PowerPoint slides because I have to have a map frame every second to show passageway through space. And if I could just simply migrate that in lecture notes into a platform and just have it and be moving through where the students are never away from space, I just think that that would be absolutely revolutionary. All I can do is say, to turn to someone else and say, wouldn't that be revolutionary? Shouldn't we do this? And I think at that next level, to go from something that is incredibly well built to a genericized Palladio-style thing, I think that's when universities and institutions, they basically see those things as a level of investment as if we're going to create Microsoft Excel, like a full-formed application that is a much bigger scale investment of user experience and stuff. And that's when even the best bespoke platforms, they decide through inertia or through a higher sense of judgment than I have, that no, this one isn't going to make the cut. This one is going to be in every theater across the country. This movie is just an indie movie. That's this challenge where I wish I had certain skills, which I don't, because I don't like being told what I can't do or mm-hmm. I have to wait for this and wait for that. I just want to, you know. But then there is a balance. There is something good about there are risks of the modular, I would say, which is that classic kind of Edward Tufte writing about PowerPoint totalitarianism is that, you know, when all you have is Palladio or when all you have is Voyant tools or when all you have is this thing, you can just see this kind of, not in the hands of serious, you know, but there's a lot of unserious scholarship that uses these kinds of things, but because of these, it's so aesthetically beautiful, they get A's in classes, they get, you know, they pass through Q&A unscathed. Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of narrowing of mind. I think there's a way out of it, which is kind of glitch DH, where you use certain things to do things they're not built for, and they still open up the possibility of alternate visualizations. And that just shoehorned a little bit in just a very quick response to the first question. Moving into this territory for this particular project and a few other things that I'm working on is really a hunch generation tool, an exploratory tool, a hypothesis sort of an instinct generation device, really, for me, and just trying to get something which surrounds me, in front of me, just long enough to have those moments of, wait a minute, what just happened there? Now, if I were an ethnographer, and I wish I were, ethnographer and an archivist, those are the two professions I wish I had done, but then go down into the field and ask certain questions or go into the archive. But going straight to the archive for a project like this, I could never hope to do it. I'll pause there.
I would just say that, I would just add to that, that what we've done so far here is it began with the British Library grant to digitize 5,000 pages of Wolof Ajami materials. Once we got the materials and Jack Ammerman and Vika's team helped us to preserve them, to make them available, it began to surround us, as he said, and we began to develop an instructional wing of it. So that the African languages that we teach at Boston University as part of the Title VI federal funded project, and our students who study the languages that have dual script, we train the instructors to generate instructional materials to teach hybrid literacy. So that's the instructional wing. And then we develop a research wing. we created a group called an Ajami Research Group at the African Studies Center, and generates peer-reviewed articles. In fact, one of my PhD students and I just co-edited a special volume that's going to come out this month to be published by BRIM. So we have Digital Humanities, we have three wings, really. Digital Humanities, which is what we've talked about, and then the instructional wing, which trains the first generation of students here at Boston University who are able to access this material that their professors weren't able to access to. And then the research wing, which tries to study in a systematic way the content of the forms and the forms of these materials. So we have three. And that's just the result as we've collected the materials and they're around us. Those led us to come up with these options here.
If you don't mind, Falou, I have a follow-up question for you. And this is based on some conversations that we had a couple of years ago, and I have no idea where things stand right now. But we talked a while ago about the politics of Unicode, right? So Unicode is a character set that defines the precise sequences of ones and zeros making up individual characters, right? Whether they're ideographs or alphabetical characters. And Unicode is used by many, many web projects as a character encoding standard. So do we need one for Ajami languages? Or for Ajami writings?
Yes.
Or do we not need it, and why?
Well, yeah. There's been an attempt to develop Unicode. I think many of them are now encoded. But the problem is they initially used a top-down model that failed. They used the already encoded Farsi and Pashto letters, and they tried to use that for Ajami, which doesn't work. And so our approach to the project we have that's dormant, and maybe we'll resuscitate it, is in fact to pull from the pool of characters that are found in our text and to encode those. So that you will be encoding from actual text, from actual letters that are supported by the text we have here, rather than the top-down model. But I haven't gone further than that. I've been very busy hunting for grants. And,
Just in case it's not clear to you why that's important, that would enable optical character recognition, for example.
Right. It's hugely important.
In those writings.
And the building of online lexicons and searchable lexicons
right.
is really very important.
You will be able to type in them, whereas right now you can't.
Right, right, exactly. Just to very quickly point out that Dan Cohen mentioned the digital repository services and Charon. Very quickly, Dan Cohen mentioned the digital repository services, and basically the project that we're working on with the Cherokee language manuscripts is one iteration of several that will be built on that backbone, if you will, and that Julia Flanders and Dan Cohen would be, I wish they were here right now to talk a little bit more about that question, because we really, really troubled and thought very carefully about how we would create functionality, how we would always allow for different types of interaction over time. And to make sure that things remain stable so that when somebody did translate a manuscript that we had borrowed from one of our sponsors or co-collaborators, that translation would remain beyond the place where it is. So, but other than that, I haven't got a better answer for you. It's a great question. There was a question in the back.
Is it on?
There we go. My question is mostly about the Chinese Death Gate kind of project you're working on, but also this question could probably apply to all of your projects. I guess the first question is, how are you going to be able to continually update it once it is live? Who's going to be in charge of the upkeep and funding the upkeep over a long period of time? And how do you preserve something like that? Because if I understand you correctly, you built this platform from the bottom up. So how is that going to affect its long-term preservation?
Great, great question.
Sure. SUP is paying for it. It'll be on, I specified to the team at the library that this site will almost certainly be hacked, given the political sensitivity of its subject matter. I don't know what you plan to do, whether or not, I mean, Stanford Within has very good, at the library level, has incredibly good persistence and, you know, multiple backup technology, but then there was this discussion that it's going to be migrated to another server that would be connected to SUP, Stanford University Press's digital publication process, and they are working with, I think, a third-party vendor, I can't remember the name of it, who, as I understand, have a lot of experience long-term sort of multi-site backup for recovery, and also that the system, even at the library side, is outfitted with persistent identifiers, so each of the essays within it has a persistent identifier. So that's on their side. After it's published, I have no funding obligations to help pay for it. So that's nice. The other side of it, update, is a question. I think there are different ideas maybe about the updatability after the published form. It's a peer-reviewed, edited volume. I mean, in essence, they don't like to use that term, but it's a platform edited volume. And so you don't update your book the day after it's published. But as you discerned, you know, it could be that a week after publication, we do determine that a particular grave relocation in Hubei province in 2012 that we did not know as much about as we would like, we find that out. And so there's this question about whether on the back end that would be done. I'm going to fight tooth and nail to say, yes, that is something that I want to be able to update. If it is a question of editing text, editing the actual narrative, I think at that level I agree with the idea that what that product is what it is. But the back-end database has to be one that has flexibility. But this is stuff that publishers have not thought through. I mean, this isn't a critique of SUP. It is saying that a press with as much experience as SUP, knowing the questions that they have not yet thought about because they haven't come up, just tells me that this is probably something that very few presses have thought out in advance. It's a lot more than just getting it on a stable digital platform and persistence. It's all different financial means, and it's all different questions of persistence. Yeah.
Alexander?
No.
Can you hear me in the
middle? No.
Don't turn it off.
Do
people turn off?
So, look, because this is an issue, a recurring issue, what you're describing, although this comment is for everybody in the form of the future of the university and the labor structure around the production of knowledge, since the cost of what building the Chinese deaf project, and David is a good friend, we've been friends forever, filters out into many indirect costs to the university for maintenance and security. With you now at this point, more or less, in that mode of authors of relinquishing a project after it has been done, the book, for others to adopt into an industrialized machine of preservation that was built for something else. And the cost of this would be the amount of money that we could use to actually pay for one or two postdocs, let's say, because this wouldn't be an FTE, that can actually do both. Think critically through the creation of the technology and produce the scholarship themselves. As we imagine the future of the university, is there room for the scholar who has an idea but the incapacity to make it happen that commands the resources of the university? Or can we build the university with a little bit less ephemerality on the labor market, a little bit more robust lives, to produce a scholarship that blends these things so that we can ask the decolonial question truly through the technology and we can imagine a knowledge production that truly belongs to us?
Mm-hmm. May I take a stab at that, even though I know that I think you were speaking to him, because there's a way in which that decolonial question is very interesting to me, because it's, to my mind, it has to do with the practices upon which we are making these archives. And so if we hope that our materials will continue forward, we need to identify the practices that are currently in place in communities and in local areas and be able to build on those so that they maintain, but also to anticipate future needs, given what on the ground are identified as future needs. That is to say, in another way, to think about the instrumentality of these and how it is that the instrumentality gains value for the people who use it. And when you're thinking of various scripts, right, and how it is that a script like Ajami might be used and useful for people, that, for me, is the very first decolonial epistemic delinking moment, because you're looking at instrumentality that is far beyond the instrumentality that a technocratic modernity of a university might identify. That's my answer. Going over to you all.
I'll just add briefly my thoughts about, especially in terms of the instrumentality. In our work, as we're trying to, in a similar way, trying to support digital publications, this is a new avenue for Illinois as well. We're really thinking in terms of the preservation of what is the core intellectual elements that are needed for people to take it in the future. So things that, you know, when the preservation, the platform, the publication gets to the point where either the author decides to update it on their own and take it to another platform, or that we commit to preserving it in the core intellectual elements, that's part of the thing that we're trying to think through as publishers as well as librarians, is, you know, what are the data elements that we can preserve so that another scholar, another group, the community, whoever, can take that data and then remake it themselves. So that's, I think, an element as well that we're similarly thinking through.
I think the point in spirit makes full sense. I would turn it into a question and ask, for the book that just came out, we just had a book event at MIT, and prior to it, I wanted to make sure that I went back over all of my communications with everyone at the press that I had interacted with, from, you know, interns to the copy editors to the PR firm to the publicist in London to whatever it was. And it's a staff of this analog book, talking about indirect costs to make it an actual question rather than a positing something into existence. We're talking about a staff of 25 people, mm-hmm. are like, make this book, and then this book occupies space and it weighs and it has paper and it's on trucks and it's being shipped and there is a carbon footprint and it is. So when we start to imagine, there's no doubt that the indirect cost of the production of a digital platform or object has all of these indirect costs. I think it is tied to these larger questions of that you ask. I'm not entirely sure. I'd like to see the math about what is the footprint of a digital project versus what the footprint is of a book. I mean, I traveled to 72 archives over 10 years in 12 countries, wow. and then worked with a staff of, add it all up, I worked with probably 300-500 people to produce one book. So if I didn't exist, if I didn't walk this earth and suck down air, yes, we could hire two more postdocs. And so there's this question of that kind of just consumption of resources and what that means and the kinds of decisions that we're making. I don't think that's a digital versus question. I think that's a question that just extends across this enterprise. Uh-huh. And then that becomes the lens of interrogation. Is okay? Do I feel guilty for that, or is there value? Was there value for those that came along for the ride, or that we were with this together? Is there value for the student that does this complete brute force work and the brute force work that I did to go through it and all? Is that of any value? Because once we hire these two other postdocs, their labor, or full-time assistant professors, their labor, guess what they're going to be doing? They're going to be writing books that involve 50 people, 500 people, many airlines. So it still reproduces the same kind of consumption and value question. It doesn't get us out of that. Mm-hmm. So I think you'd actually have to push your thinking even further in a direction than I think you think it has in terms of the intensity of your thinking about that, based on your question.
Can I add something briefly to Harriet's remarks about the portability of data and propose the maybe treating platforms as intentionally ephemeral? The questions that this conversations bring up for me are the questions that have been asked already in digital humanities and not discussed enough. We don't have answers yet. How do we treat software building as scholarship? Mm-hmm. How do we discuss it as scholarship? How do we peer review it as scholarship? How do we build a critical apparatus around it, around the process of software building, and have the end product of that process not only be the software itself, but the criticism, the self-critique around it, and the self-reflection around it, that then can maybe persist, maybe longer than the software itself, and then that knowledge be built on. I don't know. But it's worth thinking about.
Mm-hmm. Where's the microphone?
But I do think that once David has his PhD from MIT, we're all out of a job. Because he can just do it all. And I just wanted to add that. We're all done for. In a good way. Okay, good. I miss him. Tell him
go
that.
Go ahead. I'm second in line. Okay, great. Okay. Sorry. Am I here? Can you hear me?
No. Not quite yet.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Now we can. Okay,
great. My name is Juliana Richardson. I'm with the History Makers. I have a question because I've worked with the people from the digital humanities, and I find it divided into two distinct teams. The IT very focused team and the subject matter, with really more of a focus, or my experience is with more focus on what the technology will do, and not something that will sustain itself over a long period of time. And I think I have a plea in many ways or your thoughts about what could bring those two communities together on a sustained basis, mm-hmm. as opposed to project by project, mm-hmm. And why that's not happening to begin with, especially here in the academy.
That's a great question. I think we're beginning to get there. But the steps are slow, and it takes a lot of time to build those relationships between all of the stakeholders when it comes to any particular project, and developing those relationships. And it's been a curious frustration to me, and I really would love to hear more about how you developed the collaborations you did. When you spoke this morning, Vita, about that process, because you seem to have such an amazing list of collaborators at the ready for the work that you've been doing, and yes, and it's very, very difficult for me to find well, I can identify all the archives that have Cherokee language manuscripts. Sometimes just getting a return phone call from a librarian is nearly impossible, and so I have to ask every person I know, can you put me in touch with? Can you put me in touch with? And I'm not sure why that happens. I wish it wouldn't, but I'd love some insight from Vita about how she builds her
practical. Goals. I can tell you that much. Oh, Jesus Christ, sorry.
And did you want to say something?
Yeah. I mean,
but you all should answer the questions
does
too.
I just wanted to say that my collaboration with Victor's office. Can you hear me?
Nope. Joe, can you figure out this mic, please? Or give us a handheld.
Mm-hmm. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
No.
Okay.
He's going to boost the volume.
Yeah. All right. Can you hear me?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I was just going to say that our collaboration began in 2011. And I have been so blessed by that collaboration because I have learned what is a metadata and how do you create it by working with you, but also by bringing them to the field. And I think that interaction that we had in the field actually forced me for the first time to purchase a MacBook Pro, because I had resented to buy a MacBook Pro for a long time. But because Roger Brisson showed me how the software we're using for the metadata that met the requirements of the British Library and that met your requirement required to have a Mac product for some reason. And so the point is, I think by engaging people in the IT and people in, you know, in the disciplines in actual field work, so that they complement each other. Mm-hmm. In our new grant, and I think that's what we're going to do, your office is going to, Eleni from your office will be joining us in the field for 2 weeks. We will train, she will train the team, the local team, into how to use the software we have, the equipment, and how to build metadata. In the middle of the project, I will go again with her to do the same thing, to follow up, to see if there is any problem in the data collection. And we will come at the end to do a general assessment. And I think these kind of collaborations have been really fruitful to me and have also been fruitful to her as an IT person to go to the field. And I think to the extent to which we can reinforce these engagements actually in the field, both the people at the IT level who work in IT and the field, I think would really make the work much easier and produce better results. Mm-hmm. In terms of sustainability, that's your issue. I always leave it to you, because when I see a glitch or a problem, I always send you guys a link. There's a problem there. But I do think that bringing the two together in field work is one of the best ways to bring together.
For sure. And you know, even outside of the field work, our conversations helped us on the, so at that point I was the institutional repository librarian, and this was the one of the two earliest projects that we took on, you know, after the repository had gone live and was live for less than a year, and we were sort of trying to figure out, well, why do we have it? We want to do open access at BU. Well, but what does that mean though? And what is this institutional repository? And it is only through these conversations that we were able to, and with this project and other projects, that we were able to articulate what the repository is for, which is we want to collect, preserve, and disseminate as much of BU's original intellectual and creative content as possible, and preserve it long term. But without having those conversations in the first place, we wouldn't have been able to articulate that, because that process is an emergent process. Mm-hmm. It's an emergent process, and it's an iterative process. And one of the reasons that it's hard to talk about these things is because we're all still learning. I mean, there are best practices, but we're all very much still learning.
Mm-hmm.
What the possibilities are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this is where we're leaving space for serendipity, and you're right. It's crucial to have a translation space. Libraries have sort of started positing themselves as translation spaces, and I think that's not a bad idea. But it's the people in libraries and outside of them, in archives, in digital humanities or whatnot, that need to really sort of have that as a skill.
Yeah. I want to say, I think it's very important, because our project would not have even been around had there not been, first, the library impact and involvement in my project, and then second, the technologists that came from Carnegie Mellon. So everybody worked, and I just think that all of this cost a tremendous amount of money. And it, first of all, and it's so needed for accessibility. And then if you add on that, like, you know, I'm looking at the your project and the Cherokee project, and I'm like, really, are there connections there that we don't know that could bring new information to fore? And that would be of interest to me, but if we can't get to the baseline level, then
right.
we can't get to the real things that would inform real new and innovative scholarship.
Right. That's a good question.
My question is just following this general discussion. Can you hear?
Uh-huh, yes.
Sort of.
Close to them,
yeah. And it's based on, actually, first stimulated by Tom's paper, but I think it goes for the whole panel. That is, a digital project is created out of ideas. You are stimulated by
the great question.
And a technological help is sought to visualize it, to enlarge it. My question is, can that digitalized project, with all its ideas stimulated by its birth, can it pass on to a different project and retain that intellectual stimuli? That is, do we need to build for each idea, each project, a new platform? Or is that platform can be stimulating for other ideas?
This is, yeah.
Because from the panel I'm seeing now, there seems to be two, I'm an outsider, I'm only a user. I see two propensity. One is to collect for preservation and for study. The other one is for thinking. And I know I'm probably unjust by dividing these two parts, but that is a sense I get. So my question is very simple. A platform is an intellectual product. Mm-hmm. Can itself stimulate thinking?
That's a great question.
I'll jump in. I think, one of the sub-questions of does there need to be one platform per project, I would absolutely no. I mean, as someone who couldn't conceive of how to start from scratch, and as someone that is impatient by nature, and I think when my instinct is actually to figure out the kinds of availabilities out there with the willingness to use things in ways that they were not built for in order to achieve an effect that I think gets me not at a presentational space, because my horse in the race of DH is actually, it's ironic, is not at all in the manifestation or presentation of a finished product. That's what it turned out to be. That was through conversations with SUP, more than it is. It can be a very messy, kind of unpresentable, in our robe, unshaven kind of intellectual space, but that generates these sorts of things just by bringing in various modules to try some things out. That I think is a really important, for me at least, it's an important hypothesis sort of exploration, problematic in the noun sense, generator, as compared to the almost zero sense of inspiration that I get from turning on Voyant, loading up a text, and seeing the dashboard thing that looks like the same dashboard that's on fidelity.com when I check my retirement. And also, it's so crushingly normalizing that I feel nothing. And that feeling to me is what I place value on. And if it comes out of a jimmied together kind of set of things that make me have an instinct that then I'll spend 10 years figuring out whether or not there was anything there, I definitely don't think, okay, this now needs to be its own platform. That said, I do think I am really attracted. The thing I want to learn is not Python. I do want to learn Python, but it's not Python. It's processing. Processing, the language processing and the sort of platform, that's something which is so non-representational. I'm also really, I would love to do, forget data visualization, I want data materialization. I want to walk through a space where population density has been set to an acidic smell and gender migraine has been set to like garlic, and I walk through and it's shooting these things in my face, or I'm rubbing my hands over top of a material that has been 3D printed and the coarseness of it is, and I want to just rub against it and smell and try to make sense of it.
What is this, not being an artist?
And like, and just do that, because it's like, what is, like, and I want to feel an artificial manifestation of war, of poverty, of linguistic hegemony and stuff, because then I go, wait, what was that? And I it's all artificial. I have no lie to myself that this is a faithful representation, a mimetic relationship of reality. It's not, and I want to make that really explicit. That's why the dashboard kind of thing, and Joanna Drucker has talked all about this, so it's not new space, it's just so normalizing. So doesn't have to be new platforms, but it does need to be something that leaves, is not, to me, non-representational, makes explicit the non-mimetic relationship between this visualization or materialization and the phenomenon that I want to have an instinct about. Mm. That's what I need. And I wish I knew how to make it myself, but I don't. And I feel it I feel it not every day, every month.
You don't see any danger in the distancing of that kind of mediation?
Everything is mediated, so
the hyper decontextualization of that, the hyper decontextualization, the exaggerated.
No, I think not. I mean, because if you think about, I mean, to me, if you think about this idea of an orthography that can be used, I mean, Ajami is a hyper decontextualization, the application of Latin alphabet to the Central European languages is a hyper dematerialization. I mean, that's something which is kind of available in the inherent meaninglessness of the sort of semiotic things around us that cultures for millennia can lift and borrow and steal and then invest their own kind of imminent meanings in them and re-encode them. But then someone else says, I don't want to observe your imminence. Mm-hmm. I want to just surface steal that and bring it into another framework and invest it with different ephemeral, by which I mean 500-year meanings. And so any one of those I wouldn't want to decontextualize in a sort of like an offensive from outer space sort of way, but I think at the macro scale, that decontextualization is just the way it works at like a 30,000 year kind of human history kind of scale.
I think you and I are probably going to part ways because that kind of instrumentality, that kind of instrumentality, I think, is actually pretty. Okay.
Well, I was just going to say, I think that again, I come to it not from an IT perspective, but as a someone who is driven by research questions. And therefore, my goal is first to preserve as much of these documents I could preserve to make sure that they're available and they're not gonna be lost and they can challenge the myth of the holistic illiteracy of Africa. That's my first goal. While doing that, we also collect metadata that captures the context and with visual information that captures the speech communities. We interview owners of the text to have a genealogy of the text itself. But I do think that it's never a finished project. It's always enduring. Because some of the things that I find fascinating that generated my recent book may not be the same things that my students will find fascinating. May not be the same thing that an art historian, like the images, they have not been studied. So I think my goal is really to make the materials available for all the scholars around the world across the humanities and social sciences. What will happen after that, I think it will continue to be beyond my life. So And that's why I think for me, it's never going to be a finished product. It's always going to be a work in progress. Because one text of Ajami, and that's why the issue of decontextualization, I don't know if I share that. Because in fact, to penetrate one page of Ajami, like the poem on Adolf Hitler, it requires multidisciplinary skills. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You have to know the language. You have to be a historian. You have to know the local history.
You have to know the people and the practices, ethnographic
knowledge. So it is fundamentally contextualized.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And when you document this information, in fact, when you document these texts, when you collect them, we tend to do our best to collect as much metadata as possible, mm-hmm. both texts and images. And that's what we give to her and her team, which they. And I think that's the model we're going to continue to use. And until there are better technological tools to expand our projects. But in a nutshell, I think it's going to be a work in progress for a long time.
It's all about the practices.
One last question.
All about the practices. Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I just love the ideas, and I really appreciate the panelists from this afternoon. I was thinking about digital scholarship. And I couldn't resist asking Tom and Laney afterwards about Chinese Deathscapes, when it will be published and so on, and he said 2018. And will there be a book going with it? No, it's a completely, it's in cyberspace, right? Can that be correct? And he's hoping that it will be free as well. And so it's just wonderful that it's going to be disseminated globally. But my question also comes from something that I'm thinking of. Perhaps it's a tension, because yesterday morning, I just took my students, as I do every semester, to see the Martin Luther King Jr. Reading Room, where Mr. Sean Noel gave a wonderful introduction to Martin Luther King's life. And we were looking at his briefcase. Wow. We were looking at letters, of course they were behind glass. And then he invited my students to go to the archive sometime, put on the white gloves so that they can feel, they can touch, maybe they can even smell some of the archival materials. And that is just the sheer joy and pleasure and excitement of that is so, so, so important for me as an educator. So my question is, where do you, I see there's so much potential for digital scholarship, but there's also this dialectic where we're missing what you were saying just now, the palpable, the material. And when we're educating undergrads and teaching them research and things like that, but besides cyberspace, of course there should be the artifacts, the actual artifacts that one can touch and feel, if at all possible. So that's a pretty open-ended question for the group.
I'm just going to take the opportunity to hopefully, it's like that song, "Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood." I mean, with regard to decontextualization, and so, you know, in the same sense that Latin alphabet, just to use use orthography as an example, because text technology is something that I spend a lot of time thinking about. Chinese characters have been used to spell phonetically Japanese, even though Japanese and Chinese have nothing whatsoever to do with each other linguistically. If the ability for, you know, a millennium and a half, Japan to import these characters and use them in a way that is fundamentally different than how they work in their original context is the ability. It's like the rebus principle. It's when, you know, if I write "I love you" and I put that up, and I'm using a picture of an eye, but I'm stealing from it the sound in order to bring it into another context. All these different strategies in which we can, and cultures and societies do it all the time, of strategically decontextualizing something, saying, I know how this character works, I know how writing works in China, in this Chinese context. We have this other sort of system of writing,
and I will strategically decontextualize that, bring it into a different kind of regime of meaning, use it in this totally different way, and as it evolves, it becomes hiragana and katakana, and suddenly it is re-encoded with an entirely new sort of framework. If we imagine a world in which decontextualization was either impossible or just as a fundamental concept wrong, then the Japanese language couldn't exist. And these various stories that we're telling. So it's not a question of a single text and context. I mean, that is the classic, that's the bread and butter of historical scholarship. It is at time scales of much larger dimensions where these cross-cultural borrowings are possible because of the inherent capacity to decontextualize that is certainly at the linguistic level there. And then there's always very important debates at the time that it's happening of cultural appropriation and things of that nature. But if it wasn't possible, in fact, the Chinese language, in order to grow, in fact, stole from itself, like decontextualized certain characters and made them do things that they originally had no context to do. So that's just one thing that I wanted to put out. It's not about sort of just going into an archive, taking out a script, and then imagining that you can read it and understand it in a totally decontextualized framework. In the sense of your question, I'll just keep it very brief to turn it over entirely to the other panel. For me, the priority is the material and the analog, and you know, in the question that I tried to raise earlier, I would like the conversation with my students and with my colleagues to ask questions of how can we have a massive online course in which there's a lecture where people log in and listen, and then the assignment is go get on your bike or your bus or like hitch a ride to a participating county archive that is part of this course, where you will work on materials that deal with labor history. It might be mining here and shipbuilding here and coal here and transportation here, and then we'll get back online, and then we'll go back off, and that's the online, not as a surrogate or the next phase past this period where we're imagining we're leaving, but as a way to bring into circulation the unfathomably large, underused archives that are just all across the world, certainly across the United States, and use digital means to get them. Not simply the idea that the only way we can do this is by digitizing those archives and putting them online, and that's how we'll solve this problem. Because that's just probably not going to happen. There's not enough money in the world.
Harry, I wonder if you have something to add to this from the library's perspective.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess from a very practical perspective, we do realize that there's nothing that will replace the material. And so it's, you know, kind of echoing what they were talking about this morning, providing people access to it, but also there's technologies in some of the projects I've worked on where we allow people to see particular materialities in terms of doing, kind of seeing the, you know, eliminated manuscripts and being able to mine below those and allow students to really see different aspects of, say, rare books, and then connect them directly to that archive so that they know where the book is coming from. They can, and there's, you know, of course, technologies that are amping up every day that allow people to really examine it, but still say, here, you need to go to Germany or you need to go to Peru to actually do these books. So I think there's ways that we can connect researchers to the archives more directly in through digital technologies.
Anybody else?
Yeah, I would come back to, I would prefer, I think, as an intellectual discussion we can have, I would prefer to recontextualization rather than decontextualization in the conversation on how scripts get borrowed. And I would prefer borrow rather than steal. Because if you look at the history of world languages, especially world religions, let's just take Abrahamic faith. The spread of those religions has also spread the spread of those scripts, right? So the Christianity was a vehicle through which the Latin scripts spread throughout the world. The same with Islam. And so that continuity is still there. So even if you use the Arabic script to write Uyghur in China, you still have the Islamic dimension there. It's not as if you were decontextualizing. I wouldn't say decontextualizing. I would say you are actually giving it, adapting it to new context. So I would prefer recontextualization rather than the context is regardless of the number of centuries that is between them. So that's number one. Number two, I think that, I mean, again, I'm saying not from as an expert in digital humanities, I'm just speaking as a researcher interested in these long durée perspectives. Because when you look at the long durée perspective of the borrowing of these scripts, you will see that actually it doesn't belong to anyone. Because in reality, what is Arabic script today is an adaptation of the Aramaic script. Right? So who owns the Arabic script? You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
So that's why I prefer re-contextualization rather than de-contextualization.
Shall we give Ellen the last word?
I was only going to echo that and say replacing might be one way to look at it, or thinking about how the instrumentality is related to the actual practices that were attendant on the mediation and how it is that that carries forward in any kind of code meshing. And that's the important place to really think through the most powerful kind of code meshing acts of replacement. Mm-hmm.
Thanks to all of our panelists.
Thank you. What a great panel. Thank you all.